I have a niece who is now grown up, but when she was a child, she was very difficult to punish. I felt bad for my brother and his wife, because whatever they tried, she didn't mind. For her, the timeout step was like a vacation. She'd sing, she'd whistle, she'd grab something to read. There was nothing that they could threaten her with that bothered her. Every attempt got turned into something positive. It was like threatening Gandhi with missing dinner. She didn't care. And so they faced, in an extreme situation, the problem that every parent faces, which is, how do you threaten enough to be effective and not go overboard? How do you not threaten too much or punish too much? Because punishment is, of course, a very finely calibrated thing, and not only that, but not every person punishes the same way. People, as Emerson put it about anger, boil at different degrees. One child, you'll just hint at a threat of a punishment and they'll fall apart. My niece, didn't affect her at all. And I bring this up because of this morning's Parsha. This morning, we read what is called the Tochecha, which literally means the rebuke. But what it actually is a litany of the most horrifying, terrible, unimaginable punishments that God threatens to visit on Israel if they misbehave once they get into the land. Now, I'm going to tell you a not so very great secret among rabbis, which is, on this Shabbat, there are one or two passages in this section of the Torah that rabbis love to talk about because no one wants to talk about the rebuke. It's just way over the top. It's just too awful. And the idea that God, as a parental figure, as you heard this morning, would want to threaten so horribly, puts us off. And as you read it, you think, these are things that couldn't even possibly happen. But then, of course, you remember Jewish history. And you recall what Abba Eban said, that there are things in Jewish history too terrible to imagine, but nothing too terrible to have happened. And part of what I want to say this morning about the Tochecha is that it may not be effectively conceived of as God's deliberately saying, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. But rather, God's teaching us that we should know that the world is set up such that if we are not careful in our social arrangements, terrible things will happen to us. If you set your society up in the wrong way, or having set it up carefully, if it veers off into a dangerous direction, the world can explode and this morning's Tochecha will seem not like a horrendous prediction, but like reality. We know that it's true because such societies have unfortunately characterized the 20th century. So what seems a terrible threat may just be an honest warning. But as I was reading through the Tochecha, something struck me that has never struck me before. And I looked through the commentaries, and of course, commentaries for any verse in the Bible are so voluminous that it takes a lifetime to go through them all, but I couldn't find a comment on this fact which really seemed to me notable and strange. Remember, if you threaten someone, then the effective way to threaten is to start small and build up. You don't say, I'm going to kill you, and then no television. This is like the famous passage in Thomas De Quincey, the English essayist, essay on the fine art of murder, where he basically says, if once you commit murder, then you come to think nothing of theft and Sabbath breaking. And the reason that the passage is supposed to be funny, of course, is it reverses the usual order. Because everybody knows that you build up to stuff. Right? You don't say, don't get started with heroin because it leads to marijuana. So the same here. You'd think that God would save all the really worst stuff for the end. But what's the end? After how the land will be devoured and people will die in terrible ways and families will turn on each other, then God says, and I will send you back to Egypt. And I'm thinking, so? I mean, Egypt was no picnic. But when you read the rest of it, even to go back to Egypt, even as a slave, it doesn't really feel like the worst thing that could happen. And so I started to leaf through the commentaries to try to find an explanation, and I couldn't find one. I'm sure there is one, but I couldn't find it. And so I began to think. The first obvious explanation is that Egypt in some way reverses the whole story of the Jewish people. We started out there, we were liberated, we have a land, we build up that land, and now we've got to go back to square one. It is, if you will forgive the triviality of the analogy, like going back around the Monopoly board, you got to start it go. But that clearly, as bad as it is, that wasn't horrible enough. Not to put it at the end of a series of terrible threats. And so I began to think about what it was that liberation from Egypt is supposed to represent. And it's clear, if you give it just a moment's thought, it represents God's expression of faith in the Jewish people. Otherwise, why liberate? If they're not going to be anything in this world, leave them in Egypt. But God is convinced that Jews will make something of themselves, that they'll contribute something to the world, that they will be worthwhile. And he needs them out there spreading through the world because they have something to say. So he says, let's bring them from this seething cauldron of slavery in Egypt and let them loose on the world and let's see what happens. So what does it mean to bring the Jews back to Egypt? It means that God has lost his faith in us. And there is nothing more terrible than that. And I think about this in particular because these days, as we were just talking about a moment ago, some of us, when the Torah was going around, there are a whole series of books being written about how people shouldn't have faith in God. I'm actually going to have a debate with the authors of one of them, Sam Harris, in November at the American Jewish University here in Los Angeles. And even though I think the books are wrong and misconceived and all the things you would expect a rabbi to think about such books, I also think that for us, as we approach the High Holidays, the question shouldn't be whether we have faith in God, but whether God has faith in us. And that has to be answered not only on the level of the Jewish people. And we shouldn't start out by assuming. You have to begin from the ground up. Where are we? What should we be doing? What are we doing? It's also an individual question. Because faith in the Jewish tradition is expressed by a word, bitachon, and bitachon doesn't exactly translate to faith. It really translates to trust. You have to earn someone's trust. So it's worth asking yourself this year, have you earned God's trust? Should God have faith in you to be the person that you ought to be, given all the blessings that God has given us? And before you answer the question, just let me remind you of what our sages knew and what modern psychology teaches, which is that it is very easy, well, not very, it takes some work, to accurately estimate someone else's goodness. But we all tend to overestimate our own. When you ask people, how much do you think your neighbor gives to charity, they generally do pretty well. When you ask them, how much do you give, they way overinflate the amount that they give, not because they're lying, but because they believe it. Because we all have, you should forgive me, an internal lawyer that's always arguing our case. The only reason you didn't contribute there is they won't handle your money well, not because you're not generous. The only reason you weren't nice to that person is they don't really deserve it, not because you're not nice. But in fact, the best way to estimate your own behavior, to know how good you are, is not to look inside and see what you feel, but to look outside and see what you do. If you feel charitable, but you give away nothing, I'm sorry, you're not charitable. If you feel kind, but you know that you're always saying cutting things to people, you're not kind. In the game of whether you deserve trust, intentions matter a little, actions matter a lot. And when we look back on the past year, we have to look back on what we have done, not what we intended to do. If we're trying to earn God's trust, we have to realize that if we were cruel to other children of God, we've broken his trust. That if we were blessed, but we don't bless others, then we were blessed to no purpose, and we have violated God's trust. The series of curses seem distant to us because we don't live them. But many have, and many do. And to escape the kind of world that this week's Torah portion describes imposes upon us a huge responsibility. V'ta'anitem et nafshotechem. On Yom Kippur, we're not supposed to think about ourselves, hey, I'm pretty good. V'ta'anitem et nafshotechem is to afflict your soul. And what does it mean to afflict your soul? Let me give you an analogy. If I play a piece on the piano and I only make 100 mistakes, I stand up delighted. But if a virtuoso plays a piece on the piano and makes one mistake that I can't even hear, they get up disgusted. Why? Because if you have high expectations for yourself, then small slips will upset you. And what our tradition asks is that when it comes to our souls, we bear high expectations. On Yom Kippur, we shouldn't say, hey, I've been pretty good, because we should be better than that. Oh, I've loved enough, because nobody's loved enough. I've given enough, I've cared enough, I've tried enough. It's not true. And we all know it. As we are, as I never tire of repeating, luckier than over 99.8-9% of people who have ever lived. What does God expect in return for the trust that God has shown in us? Going back to Egypt means the experiment has failed, and there is nothing left. Each year we read the Tochecha before the High Holidays to remind us that we have been given this incredible opportunity to influence God's world. I hope that this is a year in which we discover, first of all, inside ourselves and in our world, a deep faith in God, a realization that this world is more wonderful, more magical, more mysterious, more inexplicable than the human mind can explain or understand. But from the point of view of the health of our souls, I pray also that God has faith in us, so that we might, as we pass through this time of self-examination and self-renewal, know that that liberation of long ago was an experiment that in God's beautiful but troubled world is still bearing fruit and creating blessing. Shabbat Shalom.